Well, as I said earlier, this, we voted, what, about a month or so ago to change the last meeting of the month into a speaker's meeting and also have our brunch following this meeting. And I thought about who to ask to do our first speaker meeting to share her story. And one of the first people that I thought of was Gail, because I've known Gail for a while, both professionally and personally, and she's one of those people personally, when I hear speak in one of the meetings up here, that I really listen to because I like what she has to say, and it always somehow hits home with me, and it always means a lot to me. So I've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks, and with that, I'll turn it over to Gail. Thank you, Gail.
Yes, I am Gail, and I am an alcoholic. Something out of each day at the beginning, because it reminds me of why I'm doing this. Loneliness and isolation are familiar states to most of us. We often protected our insecurities by hiding out, believing that we'd survive if others didn't know who we really were. But we discovered that our insecurities multiplied. The remedy is people, talking to people, exposing our insecurities to them, risking. The program has taught us that secrets make us sick, and the longer we protect them, the greater our struggles. The program promises fulfillment, serenity, achievement. When we willingly share our lives each day, we can brighten our burdens and help another lighten hers too. And with that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and a lot about what it's like now, hopefully. I was born in November 21st, 1942, about 100 miles from here, at Fort Benning, Georgia. And I was born to parents who were alcoholics, and they were practicing their disease. Today I realized that for a long time I didn't know what was wrong with them. They felt that they were too young to have children when I was born, and they gave me to my grandparents to raise. And looking back now, I know that I always thought that that was what was wrong with me. I never looked anywhere else for a reason with what was wrong with me. That was it. That was because they gave me to my grandparents. If they had kept me, I would have been all right. They didn't just give me to my grandparents and leave me alone. They came back every week to see that I was being raised right. And at the end of the visit every Sunday, my father would take off his belt and just beat the shit out of me. I mean, I would be beat to where I was black and blue for no reason. And he would tell me, he said, that's in case you have done anything wrong during the week. So I never knew how to get approval. I always looked at it like I was being punished for being bad. And I didn't even know what I had done to be bad. And when he would leave, my grandmother would hold me and she'd say, well, you know he's crazy. And I did. I really grew up knowing that man was crazy. The only other contact I really had with my parents was my mother would come running to my grandmother's when he would beat her. And that would be the only time I'd ever see my mother, was when she had been beaten by him. And she would come in with the black eyes and the big lip, and she would say how bad he was. And then she'd get up the next morning and go back to him. Well, I grew up, in my mind, I said, I will never be like that. I will never live with a man that beats me. And so I was getting messages all along, and I got a break. For 3 years, my parents went to Japan, and I lived a normal life. I mean, there was no beatings or insanity. But I still felt different. In school, I always felt like I wasn't as good as, I wasn't as pretty as. I grew up thinking I should be better, I should do better. If I got a B, I should have gotten an A. If I got a C, I should have gotten a B. I should always try harder. Nothing was ever good enough. When my parents came back from Japan, I went to live with them. And this was going to fix me. This was what had been wrong with me. So when I went to live with them, I was going to get fixed. It took me about 2 days to realize that wasn't going to fix anything. So I ran away. And I ran back to my grandparents, and my parents come and got me. And I knew that I had to go back and live with him. It was beyond me having a choice in the situation. And by then I had a brother that is a year and a half younger than I am. And he was raised in that insanity. So when I went to live with him, I tried to get him to see this ain't normal. But there was no convincing him that that wasn't normal. He thought that was perfectly all right. And I went from being an only child to having to share all the attention and the time, and I did not adjust well at all. My parents didn't know exactly how to handle me because I had been raised where I could do anything I wanted to. And then I went to an environment where everything I did, if I didn't do it the way they wanted it done, I was punished. And it was real hard for me psychologically to see where that made any sense at all. And I just felt like I was being punished all the time. I wanted out. From the time I went at 8 and a half, I wanted to get out of the house, and I didn't know how to do it. And my teenage years were just geared toward getting out of this house. My mother had another child when I was 11 and a half, and she just practically gave her to me to raise. And I resented it. I resented my sister for being born, and I had just come to grips with that. I resented having to take care of her. I didn't want responsibility at all for anything, let alone another human being. And I remember I used to be making her formula, and I didn't care what I put in it. I don't know how that child survived. It was by the grace of God, because I certainly didn't help him out. My whole teenage years, I had to drag that child everywhere I went. But that bonded me and my brother, because we stuck together. He didn't like her either. And to this day, she has no recollection at all of her childhood. And it's a good thing, because we were cruel to her. And I really didn't feel guilty. I felt like she was my mother's responsibility, not mine. And it had just been dumped on her, so I had no guilt associated with that at all. Well, I started looking for a man to marry. I knew that that would be my way out. I was going to get fixed. I was going to get married and live happily ever after. I figured if Cinderella could do it, I could do it. And so I set out, and looking back now, it didn't matter who it was. My grandmother had told me that marriages were made in heaven. And I felt like if I just got married, it was going to be to the right man, and it was going to work out. And I believed that for 20 years after I got married. I kept trying to make it work out. But when I was 15, I married this I met this sick little fella that said he would marry me, and we were in Germany at the time. And we went on vacation with my parents, and I had my first drink on that vacation. And I was 15, and I was in a bar, and it was a slow gin fizz. It was cherry, and it was wonderful. And the first one I had, I just loved the way it made me feel. It made me beautiful, it made me witty, I could talk, and I had another one. And I was very aware that if I stayed until I got all I wanted, I'd still be there. But I had watched my parents and their drinking, and I didn't want to end up like that. I did not want to be an alcoholic. I wanted just to feel like I felt when I drank that one time. I wanted that. And I found that in my mind as being the answer. If I ever wanted to feel good, I'd have a drink. Well, I didn't have another drink for a year and a half. I got married a year and a half after that to this guy. And we moved back to Germany. Well, 3 weeks after I was married, I knew that I had done the wrong thing. I had the same feeling that I had when I had went back to my parents. To live. I knew it was wrong and there was no way out. And so I said, well, it's only forever. I'll live through it. And so I decided, well, there was no option. There was no coming home. There was no way to get home. And so I set out to make the best of it. I got pregnant within the first 2 months, and I really felt threatened because I wanted to be the parent that I had never had. And there was no way I was going to break up a home to start off with without ever trying it. No matter how miserable I was, I thought I owed it to the child. And there was two other children, and shortly thereafter, within 3-4 years, I had 3 children. So I was trapped in the marriage, I thought. All I did was finish high school. I had no way of making a living to support 3 children. And I figured that if I tried hard enough, long enough, I could change it. In time, I was going to change it. And it was always going to be better next month, next year. When the kids were in school, it was going to be better. When they were out of school, it was going to be better. But it was really, the insanity for me was hope, was the belief that it was going to get better month after month after month. But if I hadn't believed that, I couldn't have held on. I would have just committed suicide. Because there was no way I thought that I could take care of myself. That was beyond my comprehension. I was never taught that you have to take care of yourself. I was taught that you find a man and you marry him and he's going to take care of you forever and ever. And you take care of him, he takes care of you. Today I know that's bullshit. Today I know you take care of yourself. But I've learned that in this program. It was not anything that I knew before I come in this room. My drinking started when I got married. And at first it was just parties. Parties were acceptable drinking for me. But from the very first, I was aware that I did not drink like everybody else. I drank to get drunk. Everybody else drank to have a good time. And my good time was contingent on how drunk I got. I didn't do it very often, maybe once every 2 months. But when we moved back to the States and the kids were out of diapers, it was the 60s, and I don't know how many people remember the 60s very well, but it was kind of a fun time for drinkers because we had what we call house parties every weekend, and you would rotate houses, and it was like 5 couples that would get together and drink for hours, and you would dance, and you would have snacks and stuff. And for me, the challenge was not to piss somebody else's wife off, to leave the party with the husband wanting to come back next week, but the wife not mad at you. Because if you messed that up, you didn't get to drink that weekend. Well, I had 2 sets of friends so I could drink on Friday night and Saturday night. That should have told me something. And it was bring your own bottle. And I would bring my own bottle, drink out of somebody else's, and have that bottle to drink during the week. I love bringing your own bottle. And then if the party was at your house, you hope somebody left their bottle. And that would get me from 1 week to the next. As my husband got promoted, and he was the type of person that image was everything. And I knew to him, if I made an ass out of myself, he would leave me. There was no fine lines there. That was the way it was. And so I started control drinking. I would have a drink to relax, to go out, and then at the party I'd have 2 drinks. And then I would come home and drink the whole bottle. To him, that was okay. As long as I looked good outside, I was all right. And that continued as he climbed the ladder. And then that wasn't enough for me. My disease said that I needed more, that wasn't filling what I needed. It might be all right for him, but it wasn't all right for me. And I thought, well, what I need is a job. I need a profession. So I went to nursing school. This was in 1972. And that was going to fix me. That was what was wrong with me now. It wasn't the husband, it wasn't the parents, it was I needed something. I needed security of my very own. It couldn't come from him anymore. And so I went to nursing school. And I did good in nursing. And what I realize now is it was my disease telling me, when you get when you're a nurse and you're making your own income, you can drink just the way you want to drink. You're going to have your own money. Nobody can tell you what to do. And that's pretty well how I lived my life. After I graduated, I had more money than I had ever had before, and I had a purpose. And I hadn't expected to get a purpose for life out of that degree. I felt like I was really taking care of these people. I had been born to take care of other people now. It was, the kids could take care of themselves, the husband could take care of himself, but now I had sick people to take care of. And it did. It filled up the hole a little bit. But at the end of every night, I'd go home and I'd get drunk. And I noticed this become a pattern, and I could afford it now. And I deserved it. I really thought I deserved it. That was my reward for having a purpose in life. And so that was my pattern. I began working so I'd have enough money to drink, and I only worked to drink. And I can see that that was from the very start, but it took a long time for me to get that honest. I moved to Marietta. He was transferred in 1976, and we moved up here to Marietta, and this was our first geographical cure. This was going to fix the marriage. We were going to leave the past behind, and I don't think I ever said I was going to quit drinking, but I was going to cut down. And I was very aware that drinking was a problem in my life. I had been to an AA meeting by this time. My parents, my father had went into AA, and he just thought it was the most wonderful thing, and I ought to try it. And so I went with him to a meeting, mainly just to shut him up. But when I went, I saw these nice people. And I said, well, if I end up there one day, it won't be that bad. And to me, it took me 9 years to get to this program. But I always knew when I got here, it wasn't going to be that bad. When we got to Marietta, it took about a year for the drinking to get back full blast. I was working on a cancer floor at the time. And if anything ever gave me an excuse to drink in my mind, it was that. It drained me emotionally and physically. And it was kind of like I got real confused about my own death, watching people die. I was real confused about what life was all about, because these cancer patients were just the nicest people in the whole world. That was the one common thread among all of them. And here they were dying horrible deaths. And I got my own mortality mixed up in that, and it was real confusing to me to find out a purpose then for my being alive, because by then I knew I was drinking, I was working to drink, and that I wasn't really all that into helping other people. The marriage kept getting worse. It got broke out for another year because my husband was put on the road. And he was gone 5 days a week and came home for the weekend. So that gave me 5 days a week to drink. And I sobered up for the weekend. And then as soon as he walked out the door on Sunday afternoon, I popped the top on the bottle. And so that he was promoted again, and we moved to Rome, Georgia. And this is kind of the beginning of the end of the marriage. By then the image was gone. I couldn't put up a front anymore. I couldn't even last 2 hours. And so he just kind of flipped me out of his life. He carried on his business and he would come home. So I was working then, and I found 3-to-11 shift. And I loved it because I could come home and everybody was in bed and I could drink. And they didn't bother me. I mean, it was like I lived in my own little world. And I loved it. I didn't have to bother with any of them. If they had a serious problem, they left me a note. And they really didn't want an answer. They just wanted to let me know. They wanted to feel like I was part of the family. But I really wasn't, and I knew it. And I could see that I was losing the things that meant the most to me. The kids were always, it was always like I was very responsible for their happiness. And I never really enjoyed them. It was more like they were a burden. And I was aware that what I was doing, I was not being the good mother that I wanted to be. I wasn't living up to my own expectations as a wife, as a mother, as a nurse, as anything, as a person. And I didn't know what to do to change it. And I tried to read self-help books. I read every self-help book out. And it didn't tell me how to change those people. It didn't tell me how to change my husband and my kids. And I didn't know that what I had to change was me. I could never see that I was the problem. I decided that it was like I could see the hurt that I was bringing on the kids. I mean, they were ashamed to bring their friends home. They never knew when I was going to be laid out in the middle of the floor. And so I left. I just got drunk one night, and I called a friend that I had worked with at the hospital. And I worked with this girl. I mean, I had known her for like a month, but I had known her. I had known that she drank like I drank for 2 weeks. And so I asked her to come pick me up. And I thought, this is going to be the turning point. He's going to see how much he's going to miss me when I'm gone. And I was going to be gone for 2 weeks because I had a seminar coming up that I had to go to, and I had it all planned. Well, I packed my uniforms because I knew I had to keep working, and I left. And that was in 1980, in February of 1980. And I have not seen my ex-husband but once since then, and that was briefly at one of the kids' graduations. Once I walked out of the house, there was no going back. he never missed me. I called, I guess, after 2 weeks to let him know I would come back home. And he said, no way. Well, it took me a long time for me to admit that I had left him. I told everybody, he left me. And it was so odd because I wasn't living there. We didn't file for a divorce, or he didn't file for a divorce for 3 years. And he would tell the kids, but she left me. I didn't leave him, but I wasn't there. And to me, I justified and rationalized everything I did. But what I really wanted was to drink like I wanted to drink. I didn't want to feel guilty about it. And this is my 2 years at the bottom. I moved in with this girl, and she says, oh, you can stay as long as you like. Well, we drank around the clock. We got a job. She was such an enabler, and to me, it was a mirror image because I could see myself in her, but I couldn't. I could not see that I was just as bad as she was, and she could not see that she was just as bad as I was. And we always looked at the other one and thought, when I get as bad as she is, I'll stop. We kept changing jobs, and we finally got a job in Carrollton where we could work weekends. We worked for the Baylor plan, so we just worked Saturday and Sunday, and we had the rest of the week to drink. And that's when I really hit bottom. That's when I became aware that there was a personality change when I didn't have a drink in the house. And when I would get to the liquor store and had the bottle in my hand, I knew it was all right. And my personality would be fine without ever taking the drink, just knowing I had it, I was all right. And that everything was going to be all right. As long as I had a drink, everything was going to be all right. And it was fine, except the insanity of our relationship just about killed us. I was crying one night because I didn't have a husband and the kids were gone and all this. And she was going to put me out of my misery. So she got a shotgun, and she was going to shoot me. And we lived in a trailer, and I was running, and you can't run real fast in a trailer. And I was drunk anyway, and I fell down, and she took the gun, and she put it to my head, and she was going to pull the trigger. And she pulled it, and it clicked. And I managed to crawl up under her, and I ran out of the house where her parents lived next door. And I ran over, and I told them that she had tried to kill me. And they said, Gail, you know she's crazy. And I stayed another couple of months. Then I knew that God wasn't going to let me die. And I knew that I couldn't go on living there, that it was getting worse. So I moved in with my oldest daughter and her husband. Well, the stipulation of moving in with them was that I would never drink again. And I knew that that was beyond anything I could ever promise anybody. By this time, I was very aware I was alcoholic. So I told her I wouldn't drink. And this is when I began my closet drinking, and I literally was a closet drinker. I kept the bottle in the closet. It was not hidden from anybody because everybody knew I was drinking. But the only time that I came out of the room was to get some more ice, to get something to mix the drink with, or to go to the bathroom. That was the only time they saw me. And what I wanted to do was isolate enough that I didn't hurt anybody. I just wanted to drink myself to death. And I still had to work to buy the booze. And I guess that kept me from, I don't know what it kept me from, but it was a fact that if I was going to have booze, I had to buy it myself. And so I kept walking on the weekends, and I drank all week. Well, I got drunk one night, and I talked kids into moving to Marietta. And they, even through all this, they believed in me. So they said that would be a great idea. So we picked up the next weekend and moved to Marietta. And I kept the job in Carrollton on the weekends, and I got a job here in town. And in my mind, that was going to cut down on my drinking. If I was working all them hours, how could I possibly drink? Well, I went through 3 weeks of orientation. There was no problem at all because I was off every weekend, and I worked the other job. Well, I quit drinking just about for those 3 weeks, but at the end of the 3 weeks, I said, I can't do this. So I quit the job in Carrollton and just had 40 hours a week. Well, when I went back to drinking, the progression of the disease was unreal. I was drinking from the time, I would buy the bottle on the way to work. I had never done that before because I didn't want anybody to see me in my uniform. And it got to the point where I had to know that the bottle was in the car before I went to work. So I had been there 7 weeks when I got fired. They said that they smelled liquor on my breath. Well, the amazing thing is that I had not been drinking that day. And it's by the grace of God that I had not been. I mean, it was not unusual for me to have a little vodka and mouthwash before I went to work. I mixed my little drink. Before I went to work, I would have half vodka, three-fourths vodka, and the rest I'd fill up with mouthwash so nobody could smell it, because we all know vodka don't have odor. But that particular day, I had not been drinking. If I had, I know I would have went home and committed suicide. But it was enough for me to know that if it didn't have, I had saved my license that day. But I knew that if it kept on, that it was just a matter of time till I lost my license. And at that time, that's all I could see that meant anything. So it was like a week, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but it was like for the first time in my life, I could see if I didn't quit drinking, the jobs were going to get less and less and less. I would be sweeping floors. And I had to make up my mind if drinking was worth it. And for the first time in my life, I said, it's not worth it. 2 weeks before I had been fired, I was working on a cancer floor. I had just gotten transferred up there for one day. I got pulled up there. And there was a 28-year-old woman that was dying of cancer, and she was literally in her last hours. And I said, God, let her live and let me die. I am just occupying space. And I think I was aware that nothing I did was going to kill me. And today, I know that God had to let me hurt that bad to be ready for this purpose. I went to Rome 2 days before I came in, no, 1 day before I came in the program. And I rode up there with the kids, and I went back to see this girl that I had lived with. And she says, well, you can always move back in here. And I knew that if I chose that path, that it would be more of the insanity that I had lived all my life. And I knew if I quit drinking, I didn't know what to expect. But I wanted whatever that other path was. And I remember running out her door, and as I went down the steps, I slipped. And I had not been drinking enough to be falling down drunk. But when I hit the ground, I couldn't get up. And I was very aware that something was holding me on the ground. And I did not want to be laying on the ground when the kids come to pick me up. And I had already called them. And I said, God, please let me get up before the kids get here. And he said, no. And I stayed there. And I said, God, please help me. And I got up. It seemed like it was hours before he'd let me up, but I know it was just minutes. And I got up before the kids got there, and they pulled up, and I got in the car, and I slept all the way back to Marietta. And that is the first time I've ever slept in a car, because I had a fear of dying in a car wreck. And that night, the desire to drink left me. I don't know if it was before I ran out of the house, but it was right when I decided not to take the path to live with this girl again. And I ran out the door and I left a bottle of vodka, and I had never ever left a bottle of vodka and or anything else. And I came back to Marietta and I slept that night. I slept like I have never slept before. And I woke up the next morning and I knew I was going to call AA. Now, where this came, one time my father had said in the kitchen, if you ever need help, call AA. And I thought, this is the time. So I got up and I told the kids that I was going into AA. And my daughter says, do you want me to go to a meeting with you? I said, no, I'm going to be going the rest of my life. And I don't know where all of this comes from. But I called Rebos. It was July the 4th, 1983. And it was about 1 o'clock. And they were making ice cream here. The club was open all day that day. It was Monday. And this guy answered the phone, and he says, do you want us to come out and talk to you? And I said, yes. You know, I was ready. Y'all come on over. And I went in the bedroom, and I looked horrible. Oh, God, I looked bad. And I put on clothes, and I couldn't do too much. It was I didn't have the energy to do much. And I wanted to clean up the house, and it was maybe 2 miles from here, 3 miles from here. And they were there in no time, but I was trying to straighten up the house so it didn't look so bad and get me straightened up. And they came in the house, and it was a guy and 2 girls. And these people, every time I see them today, they're very, very special people to me. It's a bond between us that, it's like they saved my life. And they came in and they started to tell me their stories. And one girl had only been in the program, well, 2 of them had only been in the program like 3 months, and the guy had been in there a couple of years. And they just looked so well. And I was talking to them, and they told me that it was going to be all right. And what I needed to do was come down here to a meeting, or come down to Reba's, that they were having this celebration and all this. And I said, all right. And so they didn't have to tell me their stories, and I could tell, like I am when I go to a 12-step call, they were all ready to lay all this on me. And no matter what they said, I was ready. I mean, y'all don't have to tell me all that. Let's go. And so I got to the club, and, well, we got out in the yard, and there was only room for 3 in his truck. He had a pickup truck. And I looked at my car, and I had a fear of driving also. I had not driven ever, if I could get somebody else to do it. And I looked at the car, and I went in and got the keys, and I said, I'll follow you because I know I'll be going back. And so I did. I followed him to this club. And from that day on, I never had a fear of driving. I mean, it was like one miracle right after the other. But God had to remove all this fear so I could function. There was no way that I could have functioned without a drink, without some of the fear being removed. Okay, I got to AA, and that day I had hope. I left this club with hope. Louise and May were here, and they loved me into sobriety that day. They told me it was all right to cry. Nobody had ever told me it was all right to cry. My ex-husband used to tell me to shut up. He didn't want to see the tears. And it was like they understood the pain. They understood where I was coming from, and nobody had ever understood. They understood why I drank. Nobody ever understood why I drank. And so I left the club that day with hope. They told me I picked up the white chip that night. And I don't remember much about it, except the next morning I had the white chip. I knew that I just had to go from one meeting to the next. For me, it was that simple. To me, I had to replace AA with a drink right away. There was no choice because alcohol was how I lived. That was my coping mechanism. And I had to have something to replace alcohol, and it was AA. And I left till the next morning, and I was at the meeting, and I looked around, and I thought, I don't belong here. I felt kind of uncomfortable. And I said, I better get over this because I'm going to be here a long time. And I thought, they told me, I heard one time that Revolts was a cliquey place, and I thought, well, that's all right. It don't matter whether they like me or not. I'm going to love them, and I'm going to be here. And I knew that this was going to be my home. Well, I'd been here like 6 months, and we moved to the other side of town, and I was up at the Howard Group for over a year. And that was the best thing that happened to my sobriety because it was a real small group, and I had to talk. I had to share. There was only like 8 of us there every morning. If somebody didn't talk, we went home early. So it was like you had to do your part. And that's how my sobriety has been. I've had to do my part. Let me see how much time I've got time. I want to tell you. I'm so glad, Jim, because to me, AA, it is my life. Before I got here, that was just the stuff that got me to have a new life. But the first, from the beginning, it was, y'all identified to me what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. The self-help books didn't tell me what was wrong with me. But when you said I was powerless over alcohol, that made sense. That made more sense. That was the piece of the puzzle that made everything fit. And it was real easy for me to see that my life was unmanageable. And I had lost everything. And I didn't even realize that it was associated with the drinking. It took me listening to y'all to realize that I had lost everything because of the drinking. The second step came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I thought I believed in God. I thought I could just skip that step because the whole 2 years that I was at the bottom, I carried a St. Christopher's medal. And I would pick it up the minute I walked out of the house, and I would put it down the minute I come in. To me, I was telling God, you've got to handle it out there, but when I get home, I've got alcohol. You're off duty when I get home. But I knew that he was there those 2 years. I knew when I had that St. Christopher's medal, nothing was going to happen to me. And my faith was, I believed that with all of my heart. I could not see the insanity in my life. And I just put that on the shelf. I said, if they say I'm insane, I'm insane. And someday I'll see it. I don't have to see it right now. I see it very well today. Thank you. I see all the insanity. Step 3 was made a decision to turn my life and my will over to God. And I had to do that. When I give up alcohol, something else had to take over. I had many little things that I turned my life and my will over to, and it was my mother and my ex-husband. And when I got to this program, y'all gave me an option of turning it over to a higher power. And I never, ever dreamed that he would take care of me. I had never heard that in church or anywhere. I thought he had made me the way he wanted me, and I had to do the best I could with what he had given me to work with. I never comprehended that he would help me. And so I made the decision, and there was a long time between step 3 and step 11. But I had to learn how to turn my life and my will over. Step 4 was the first time that I ever saw that I was the problem. And all I had to do was see it in one area of my life, and I knew that I could just switch areas. I was the problem in every area. And for the first time, I could work on me. I quit looking at you and what you were doing wrong and how I could fix you. I looked at me. And step 5 was just a matter of doing it. If I had waited until I found the person that I trusted, I still wouldn't have done a fifth step. I had to go on and do it. And I chose the best friend that I had, that I did all my drinking with. And I'm not sure why, she just showed up on my doorstep the day after I did my 4th. And I knew that I was supposed to share this with her for whatever reason. And when I got through, she said, "Scales, that's good." She says, "But I wouldn't ever, ever tell anybody else." So I said, well, she just don't understand because she's not in the program. I tell you what, another thing that happened after, about trust, after I did it, I made myself trust her. I could just see her getting drunk and telling everybody what I had told her. And I just had to say, Gail, God's going to take care of you. It's going to be all right. If she tells anybody, you're going to survive. Well, a little later, I decided that it wasn't enough that I told her because she knew most of it anyway. She was just hearing a different side of the story. I told my sponsor everything I didn't want anybody to know about. The first time, I was free of guilt. And I've decided today that there was a direct relation between my drinking and those things that I did, because I don't do them anymore. That had to play some part in the things I did. Not all of the things that I did I felt so guilty about were done while I was drinking, but I know that my drinking played a definite relationship in the things that I did. Step six was where the pain came in. I was expecting it was 4 and 5. I had dreaded doing 4 and 5. But step six was when I saw me for the first time. I had the flu, and it was within 2 weeks or 3 weeks after I'd done the fifth step. And I was locked in the room in my house for 4 days with just me. And at the end of that 4 days, I could see my wanting to control the situation. I wanted to change it. I wanted to fix it. I could see my self-pity. I could see the anger. I could see the resentment. And for the first, I had never seen those qualities in me. When I did the fourth step, I just saw that I was the problem. I could not see the character defect. But at the end of the 4 days, I could see the character defect. And I was ready to have God remove the defects of character. And I did humbly ask him. Step eight was make the list. And I did that. I knew from the beginning, from the first time I heard step eight, the people that I had harmed. And I had made a list. And the amends for me started within a month after I had been in the program. But they were done in God's time, not mine. When the girl that got me fired from the hospital showed up in the new hospital where I was working, I knew why she was there. I knew that I had to make amends to that girl. And I remember saying, God, I can't do it, because I hated that woman. I really hated her. And when she showed up, I said, God, I can't do it by myself, but I am willing. And I went in the room, and she was there visiting her husband. And I had a chance to talk to her, and I had a chance to thank her for getting me fired. And for the first time in my life, I meant it, because I knew that it took me losing that job for me to quit drinking, for me to be in AA. I had to lose that job. Nothing else would have done it, because as long as I had that job, I could have afforded to quit, to keep drinking. And it was giving me enough self-esteem to hold on. But when I lost that, I lost it all. And to me, God was very gentle with me, because he put me in a place that I had only been for a few weeks. It wasn't a place that I had worked for a year and a half or 2 years or 3 years. And step nine, the amends that I made that I thought would be the easiest, I mean, it was I was aware that I should make amends to my ex-husband and my parents, but I couldn't. All I could see was how they had hurt me. I did not see how I had hurt them or how my drinking had hurt them. And it took 3.5 or 4 years into the program before I could make amends to my parents and my ex-husband. And the way it ended is the way I did it was I just had to go on and do it. I went to lunch with a guy in the program, and he says, Gail, you're going to get into pain, and you're going to have to do it for the pain to go away. And I believed him. And I went home, and I made those amends, because I knew I was going to get in pain if I didn't. And today, I have learned if I do what y'all tell me to do, I'm not going to get into pain as if I want to do it my own way, in my own time. I wanted to understand and then make the amends. But what I found out is when I made the amends, it gave me the freedom to understand. Today, I can understand. It was like all I can ever do to them, for them, or for the situation, is to say I'm sorry for my part in it. And once I said that, there was nothing else I can ever say to them. And I was free to look at the situation and to see their disease and their insanity. And today it's just all right. I mean, it gave me the freedom that step 9 gives you when you make amends. Step 10 is my favorite because I get to look at me every day and I don't let it pile up. I heard in the program a speaker say that she did a written inventory every night, and this was when I was 6 months into the program. And I said, that sounds like a neat idea. I'll try it. And I've been keeping a diary ever since that first night. And it's been a gift to me. I can look back because honesty does not come natural to me. What I write tonight, I may look back on tomorrow night and say, this is not exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. Step 11 is the conscious contact with God. And to me, that was something that I had to be willing to see. I could never hear God talking to me. Today, I know if I don't hear it, it's because I'm not listening. I could hear a song on the radio, and I know that song's to me from God. I can see popcorn, and I know he's put that in my life, and everything's going to be all right. And it's me that has been willing to listen to God talking to me. And today I'm very aware that he's in my life, and I ask him every morning to guide my thoughts, my words, and my actions. I want him to cover all my bases. And I've learned that just by asking every morning to have him go with me today, that it's removed me. It's not that he hasn't always been doing that, but I am very aware today that I need his help to get through a day. And it's just made life a whole bunch easier. I heard somebody say in the program that when they ask God to keep them sober, that if somebody had asked God to keep them sober, they didn't get drunk that day. That they had never met anybody in the program that had asked God to keep him sober, and then they went out and got drunk. And I said, well, shit, I'll just ask him every morning to keep me sober. And I've made that part of my routine. And I've also learned to say thank you every night. That was a word that was not in my vocabulary. I didn't know how to be thankful, let alone say thank you. Today, I've learned that the things that happen to me, the things that I think are bad, are usually the best things. And the things that I think are good are usually not that good. So I've learned to stay out of the judgment business altogether and just handle what comes up next and say thank you, because I am growing. I see growth. I remember the girl that walked through the door. And I'm not that person anymore. Thank God I'm not that person anymore. And step 12 is why I'm here. There's very, very special people in this room that I sponsor. And they're part of my life. They're gifts in my life. I remember the first person that asked me to sponsor him, and I said, oh, God, he finally sent me somebody to help. And that girl helped me more. So I know it's the other way around. When somebody asked me to be their sponsor, God sent me somebody that's going to help me grow. And I'm going to close now, and I have a neat little thing that I want to share with you that somebody gave me at a meeting one time. I am not like I ought to be. I am not like I want to be. I am not like I could be. But thank God, I am not like I used to be.